And, well, goes as well as you can suspect from a guy who wrote specs with holy shit. Like, oh my god, like...
It's episode 185. Welcome to the Flick Lab. How long are we still gonna go on? Welcome back from the holidays, Henrik.
Yeah, I guess it's time to start another season of this podcast. Oh boy!
Well, you have set up the mood.
Yep. Jolly and happy as always.
Jolly and happy, that's the main thing. But hey, let's have fun. Today we're gonna...
Gonna be a tall order with today's listing.
Fun. This is the kind of a catch-up episode, as we call it, where we're going to look at some movies and TV series and who knows what else Henrik has in store for you. Things that we haven't been able to talk in the podcast, in the usual episodes that we do. So it's basically just a list of what we've been watching recently. So we thought you might be interested in hearing about it after our holidays right now.
Yeah, quick thoughts about some holiday watches that we have had.
Correct.
Some good, some okay, some absolutely terrible. Oh boy.
Those are usually the most fun ones, as we can hear. Could be. So...
I make no promises.
So, is there anything that we could launch this off with? It's something really delightful. Let me see. I have some really depressing topics here. And something that is really not up for par for starting such a fanciful podcast. I think you have more to choose from.
Okay, well, yeah, I can kick us off. Let's start with a soft opener. I watched the Amazon Jack Reacher TV series season 2, known as Reacher, and it was okay. The thing with Jack Reacher as a character, I never actually understood Jack Reacher, the media phenomena that the dude became with the Tom Cruise movies, and especially with the Amazon TV series. I can understand some of the appeal. Like at the heart of it, Jack Reacher is basically an ultimate masculine male fantasy, which means that he's uber cool and uber best at absolutely everything, and no man living on this planet Earth can ever match up to his qualities. And at the same time, the dude is dry as cardboard. Like there is nothing, there's no character at all to Jack Reacher.
That's my experience as well with Tom Cruise. I mean, those weren't anything phenomenal, you know, story-wise, elements-wise. Yeah, it was nice to see those, you know, smart aleckish moments. Like, I win. But we've seen that before, and what's the reason behind the phenomenon? Don't know. Tom Cruise, perhaps? How is the execution compared to the movies?
Well, more or less the same. Oh. Like, yeah, Reacher is more bulkier, he's bigger, has more muscle. That's perhaps, like, I would say the biggest... Like, I would say that's, like, the biggest selling point of the Amazon series. The main actor, Alan Ritchson's, like, bodily transform, how muscular he is. Like, he's like a walking brick wall. And that's something, like, is aching to the book representation of the character. It's book accurate. One of the biggest things that Tom Cruise got shit for was the fact that he was shorter and not nearly as muscular as Reacher is in the books. Outside of that, well, it's basically the same shit that was the Tom Cruise films. Like, Jack Reacher has no character to him. Outside of the fact that he's uber cool and best at absolutely everything, and everything he does is super manly. Jack Reacher, the character, is like the ultimate version of male Mary Sue. when you boil down to it. And the Amazon series does nothing to actually help this fact, which makes it that the series is, in my opinion, it's as enjoyable as were the Tom Cruise films. So, yeah, I liked them. And I think that they are really good, passable entertainment. Like, the stories have a nice little mystery. Every single time somebody gets murdered, sometimes it's drugs, sometimes it's money laundering, sometimes it's illegal weapons deals, what have you. It's nice to see how Uber Reacher goes through menial situations and solves the case. That's fun to watch. But what then?
Gotcha.
I know that Jack Reacher books, they are sold as hardcovers. And if you have a hardcover in your library shelf of Jack Reacher, that's fine. I hope you didn't pay any money for it, but you got it for free, because if you paid money, I have to ask why, because Jack Reacher, the books are like, you know, at the airport, you have all those little shops in every single airport, and some of those shops have those shelves of books that you are supposed to, like, pick up. Read during your flight, read when you're at the holiday destination, and, like, airport books. And that's what Jack Reacher books are. and the TV show and the movies, they're exactly the same deal. They are like film versions of airport books. They are really nice. I like them. They don't leave any blasting memory implant in your head. It's better to read them when you are at the airplane than to twiddle your thumbs. But it's okay to read while you're at the poolside. And when you quit your holiday, you pack your bags, forget the book at the hotel room. Or perhaps even leave it there on purpose. Because you will never revisit them. And at the same way, you never revisit Amazon series, even though it's fine, it's perfectly okay.
Well, let's not diss airport books too much, because the Escape from Camp 14 by Blaine Harden is the book that I picked from the Singapore airport on my way to Manila. And we did the episode 156 Camp 14 documentary versus the book episode right there. So,
well, I'm somehow not surprised that that was also an airport book. Remembering some of my thoughts about the documentary and the fact that the most we got out of it was basically trying to figure out, was he lying about his story and how much of it was accurate?
Well, speaking of accurate, there are some pretty accurate or pretty sharp teeth in White Fang. What a bridge. Oh, gosh. From 1991. Yeah, it's a Disney movie, Henrik. You might recall it.
Yeah, I do remember White Fang. I also, it got that one sequel I watched like halfway through. And it was like, oh, okay, something else came out. Did Harrison Ford like recently make a new Fang?
He absolutely was. He sort of did. That's called The Call of the Wild, and yeah, this The Call of the Wild Harrison Ford movie is based on a book by Jack London, and White Fang is also based on a book by Jack London. Different books, but essentially very similar elements in these books and movies. And I recall watching the second part in school when I was a kid. Just one of those days, you know, when the real teacher is on a leave and then the young replacement teacher is there and has us watch movies instead of doing any studying. It's very reminiscent of the Harrison Ford film. There's the dog, there's the remote cabin, the gold fever. There's the learning to love each other and fighting the bad guys together. All that is in there. And yeah, that is because these are written by the same guy, Jack London, the books. Different novels, but the kind of similar plot essence in both of them. And the first movie, because I haven't watched the second one in a while, the first movie, it feels like one of those kind of mediocre feel-good Disney movies. And takes about an hour for the film to get, I don't know, to get anywhere with its film setup. There's these very frequent continuous shots at the dogs, and really the dog is the star here. different circumstances with dogs, occasional trouble cutting them together in a cohesive manner as it can happen with animals. But, you know, we have the genius dog here. The main reason why I did come back to this film is because we watched the Carpenter's The Thing. And these two movies, this White Fang 1 and 2, they do have the same dog. Well, Jed.
Yeah, so they do.
Yeah. This is to give him kind of a proper status here. Jed was a Pacific Northwestern American animal actor, according to Wikipedia. And in his olden days, he's still going strong here. 94 is when White Fang 2 came out. 95 is when Jed passed away. So, yeah, great stuff. And I think if you disregard kind of the predictable Disney and the slow and unimpressive things that are happening in the first film, heck, maybe check out the second film. I remember that there's at least more action in there. And if you're watching these movies for Jed as your primary reason kind of should be, then maybe you get those more interesting Jed shots in the second part. Albeit, probably a worse movie, but like, I haven't seen that movie since for the last 25 years or something, so no further comment on that. But yeah, if you're really into dogs, check out White Fang, especially if you're into Jed. Otherwise, highly skippable.
Okay. My second film on my list would be Bullet Train from 2022, which is, at least to my knowledge, the latest Brad Pitt major film vehicle that did have a large theatrical release, who is also the main reason I originally even checked out Bullet Train. Brad Pitt is perhaps one of the last what we have like old school film stars. In the sense that, you know, he invokes that kind of a old Hollywood spirit in him, and he's like one of those big names that can still like headline a film in a way that it drives the crowds into the cinemas. We have only a handful of those anymore. But Brad Pitt, perhaps Tom Cruise. I don't know if George Clooney counts, but like, you know, like those old school ish Hollywood movie stars.
So the times change. Those are now old school. The
times are changing very hardly at the moment. And like, I wanted to check this out just to see what Brad Pitt doing. Like, dude has perhaps 10 movies going for him still until he will retire. So it's kind of a last moment to check out some of that type of like film star driven cinema. And that's my main reason to check out Bullet Train. It's based on Japanese action novel Maria Beetle, which I've understood has already once been filmed as the film Grasshopper, which I didn't check out. And well, Bullet Train was heavily, it's kind of a really mixed bag at the end of the day. When the film was in production, I remember it was criticized heavily for accused whitewashing, seeing how this was a Japanese novel and now headliner is Brad Pitt, bring alongside other white Hollywood actors with him. And the film kind of, in my opinion, tries to circumvent these accusations by having this all multicultural cast, where you have Hollywood stars from all ethnicities, be they white, black, Hispanic, Japanese. You get basically big names from all groups. And perhaps that's like, the multicultural cast perhaps is like the biggest singular point that Bullet Train has going on for it. Outside of that, it's kind of a Smoking Aces situation. You have whole bunch of killers here, 13 of them, each with quote-unquote individual singular styles of killing. They're all stacked in one bullet train. It has to reach point A, point B. There is a MacGuffin suitcase that Brad Pitt is hunting for throughout the train ride, and all these killers just kind of clash together. Brad Pitt being the most interesting character in this film because his character, the Ladybug, tries to be non-killing pacifist who is trying to live this violence-free lifestyle now as he's gunning for retirement and he's getting out of the intelligence business, which does make like the most exciting fight scenes of the movie. Because during the fight scenes, Brad Pitt, his character is knowingly trying to avoid using lethal force. He's trying to pacify and de-escalate the situations. It's all the other assholes just kind of make certain that the situation escalates in a way that there is bloody and lethal violence. So that was kind of a novel twist on this violent people stuck in a thing situation framework that the film has going on. But that's kind of exactly how far it carries. Brad Pitt is fun and it makes an enjoyable performance, but the film kind of still can't escape the or save the Guy Ritchie-esque character work, where every character is introduced to you extremely quick pace, and that also means that since the characters are just going by you extremely fast, there are a lot of actors, a lot of characters, 13 of them, the main killers, and not nearly all of them get enough screen time. At the end of the day, you are focusing perhaps, like from the cast of 13, you are focusing perhaps on 5 characters. And that means that you have a hell of a lot of cannon fodder characters in this film.
I was kind of interested in going to check out the movie when it was in theaters, but just didn't do it. You mentioned that it's based on a novel. It's based on a novel by Kotaro Isaka. So what's the main argument behind those whitewash arguments? Is it really just that the novel is by a Japanese person and then therefore it's kind of whitewashing to do it as an American version?
Yeah, precisely that. More specifically, the fact that having not read the novel, but doing some background into it, all the characters are Japanese in the novel.
Gotcha.
And now you have Brad Pitt. Like, the main problem that people had here was that the main character was played by Brad Pitt, a Caucasian Western white actor.
Mm. But then again, I think the argument also goes that surely Asian cultures do that as well, vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
Yeah, kind of catering to their own audiences in that way. Not sure how bad you can consider that as being.
I can see how the argument was formed, but I can't really join the argument here.
Hmm.
I'm in the camp who doesn't believe that, you know, that the nationality or the area where a story X comes from is somehow so holy and so sacred that you can't transport it and, you know, have it remade with actors from another ethnicity. Of course, there are subtleties, there are nuances that get lost in translation, and sometimes, perhaps even quite often, that leads into a lesser product. A really good film, a really good book can boil down into an okay film because all the cultural novelties and subtleties get lost in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I wouldn't be like, I would leave the cross and the nails and the hammer at home still at this point.
Right.
But yeah, it's okay. I give it like kind of a hand wavy recommendation. The fight scenes are not as intense and as meaningful as something like, for example, in Train to Busan or in the Raid films or even that Carl Urban's Dread film. All of those have like way more heavier hitting fights. The comedic aspect here kind of still softens the violence too much, in my opinion. Even though at times it manages to hit some bone-crunching action, even in Bullet Train. But it's kind of like Jack Reacher. One situation once again. If you are gunning for an air, you know, for a leaving airplane, and you are thinking about what to check out during your flight, 4 episodes of Jack Reacher is good entertainment for the airplane. Bullet Train is good entertainment for the airplane. Most likely you won't be remembering anything from either of them. T-minus 2 weeks is my estimate. So okay, one time watch, but won't leave any impact.
All right, just to keep this action oriented and to make an extremely ham-fisted bridge once again. Eric, have you ever heard about Sanjiro Sugata, Akira Kurosawa?
At least can't recall the name right now, right here.
Yeah, this is the original film. Both films are directed by Akira Kurosawa. The first one is more respected, then there's the second part, which is also less known. Sanjiro Sugata Part 2. I checked that out because I watched the first part maybe a couple of years ago, so I decided it's time to finish this story. So, the Part 2, which also depicts this Sanjiro Sugata character, who is a judo master and fights all kinds of evil gangs and bad people when the situation calls him and brings him to these bad situations. This second part is considered more of a propaganda than the first one, if the first one indeed can be considered much of a propaganda movie. But the second one, definitely you can see how you can make that argumentation. It was the last few weeks, I believe, of the Second World War when this film was made or released. Interestingly, it depicts a kind of a rare scenario in those days. It depicts and has American guys, not sure if actually professional actors, but there are white guys there who are depicting these American characters. There are these American characters who are kind of have brought the boxing into Japan, the country. And judo and Sanjiro Sugata are kind of part of the old world, and there are some in his community who are inviting him for a match against this white guy in the ring, like a judo versus boxing. Initially, Sanjiro Sugata is definitely not interested in that, but then the situation kind of forces his hand into this kind of a matchup. But basically, it's about seeing boxing as this foreign import, export, which it is, import, and in that sense, that they also see it as some kind of a macabre game where people are just advocating for violence and blood, and basically the film kind of considers the whole boxing as a circus, which should not be brought into Japanese soil, from Sanjiro Sugata's perspective anyway. So yeah, I thought it was interesting. Other than the kind of historical connotations and that this kind of setup, it's not particularly interesting, I would say, in shooting-wise, cinematography, or anything, but it's part of its time. If you're wanting to check out some judo, though, then I think you get the better scenes and better story in the first movie. So this is kind of a... to recommend or not to recommend, wow, it really depends on your persuasions. Give it a go if you're into history. Yeah.
Okay. Giving it a go if you are into history, I watched that bloody Nun movie, The Nun. From 2023, and before that, as a kind of a memory game exercise, I also rewatched the previous film, The Nun, from 2018, because I couldn't remember anything about the first one, and the second one is some type of a sequel. And oh boy!
Well, does it deliver, Henrik? Does it have nuns?
Not actually that many. Surprisingly little nuns in a film that's called The Nun. The first one is better of the two. Can't say hands down, because the first one is like a pile of garbage. But it somehow reeks less as a pile of garbage. The first one comes from Colin Hardy, I wanted to check the film because I have seen Hardy's previous movie, The Hollow, which I felt was not the best, not necessarily worth the hype, but an okay Irish creature feature horror film. Not necessarily any type of a classic, but a good times small creature horror film set in a couple of locations was more than okay. And in the Nun, Hardy basically does kind of more or less the same stunt, kind of really simple horror film set in one location. In that case, it's a monastery, an abbey. And both of these films are kind of a mystery horror films where a bunch of weird shit is happening, and well, you already know that who's the culprit. It's the demon Valak from the Conjuring universe things, because these are tie-ins. But you are supposed to kind of be like, what's Valak's game plan this time? And it all boils down to like the game plan having some sort of a clever twist. And kudos to the first one. It was somewhat clever twist, and the abbey was somewhat creepy set location. And then you have the second one, where like, oh Christ. It's kind of like two films. It follows Frenchie, who is a possessed person from the first film. And there's an inspectory storyline trying to figure out why creepy shit is happening in the now some type of a orphanage that Frenchie is doing some gardening work and stuff like that. And the biggest problem here is that you already know the payoff to the storyline, because you know the fucking bloody Conjuring Part 3 already has like the opening segment, which states that Frenchie was possessed by a demonic spirit, etc. So you know who the bad guy is, and you know who is possessed. So there's actually nothing to investigate in Nun Part 2. You're kind of just waiting for the characters to finally pick up the pace so that they can get into the climatic end battle, which is absolute garbage. Frenchie or Valak turns into, he gets the magic amulet and turns into super demon Valak thing and causes havoc. But then it turns out that, you know, In the Christian ceremony, you have the wine and the bread, the body and the blood of the Christ. Well, I guess it's literal. Like in mass, the wine really translates into the blood of Christ, and it's not a metaphor, because at the end battle, the main nun just summons some type of a, I don't know, area of effect spell, and there's that they fight like in a wine cellar, which is like. All the walls are like loaded with barrels of wine. Red wine. Because it used to be a monastery at some point in history before it was turned into orphanage. And when they refurnished it into an orphanage, nobody actually, I guess, decided to have the barrels of wine in the cellar. Because why not? What else are you gonna do with? Sell them like a normal person? But yeah, hey, barrels of wine all around the cellar, and they have a cellar fight. And main hero casts an area effect spell by, you know, doing the right, and all the barrels explode and somehow melt Super Valak away, because the wine turned into a literal blood of Christ. And outside of that, it was just like loud noises and jump scares, and I knew we were in for a rough ride with Part 2, because it's directed by Michael Chavez, who also gifted us with the Curse of La Llorona. La Llorona? How do you pronounce it? I don't know, that drown woman Conjuring movie that absolutely nobody saw except me and quickly tried to forget, because that was hot garbage. Christ. In this case, literally, absolutely no recommendation. Like, avoid like a plague.
Oof, that was rough ride.
Most definitely. I'm actually a fan of the Conjuring films, especially the first two. The third one was like okay slash garbage, but the entire Conjuring tie-in universe thing is brain dead as hell. the production company should just drop the gambit and not follow it through, because basically all of these films suck except like the second Annabelle movie. That was okay. Annabelle creation, recreation, rebirth, afterbirth, stillborn, whatever it was. I can't remember the name. But that was a okay horror film. And that's a good, perhaps the like your best bet with the Conjuring tying movies. Like the first tying movie will always suck. The Nun one sucked. The Annabelle first one sucked. But perhaps the second one will be okay / good party watch, like it was with Annabelle 2, but not so with The Nun 2. Somehow managed to be even worse than The Nun 1, which I must address was garbage.
Hmm. It's fair to make the statement that that film probably would deserve some blows. The film already as itself is kind of a blow for the audience, but hey, how about 400 blows? Oh, God.
A segue!
There is a film by François Truffaut called The 400 Blows. It's one of the defining moments of French New Wave. And I thought, hell, what the hell? It's been on my plate for, on my to-do list for too long, so let's do this. So it basically follows this young boy who is growing up in Paris and follows kind of his misadventures, his missteps in his childhood. Basically a film that could kind of very much resonate with some kids out there, how they try to fight against their parents and fight against the police and the authority. Basically a kid who comes from pretty decent situation, but then by kind of his own volition ends up on the bad pathway and starts smoking on the streets and doesn't go to the school anymore. All this kind of misbehavior, and he tries his very best, of course, to hide it and make the image of the perfect student and whatnot, but fails miserably. There isn't much of a story per se. We're just following his adventures, and it's kind of one of those movies where you kind of just have to feel the vibe and get comfortable with these and learn these characters. I hugely did enjoy the cinematography, and I wasn't, you know, when I was watching this, I wasn't watching it with the eye of the flick lab, so I didn't have like huge mind-blowing notes to make. When do I ever have? But hugely enjoyed the camera work is what I can recall. It's a black and white film, relatively short watch. I watched it with my partner who really doesn't gravitate towards this kind of filmmaking, but he fell asleep, but he survived for about an hour.
Sounds like French New Wave.
Yeah, great watch, great watch. And especially the acting of Jean-Pierre Louat in the film. Phenomenal, really. He was just a kid who was picked from the street and gave a extremely phenomenal interview to the film crew, and the rest is history.
So the most important question concerning the film, do you see all, every single one of the 400 blows, or is it just cocktease?
Unfortunately, it's kind of cocktease. As far as I recall, there's no even blows there.
Well, fucked. Okay.
Not in any sense of the word.
Well, in that case, you know, stick with Mel Gibson's The Passion of Christ.
I'll go with that.
You get the blows there, I guarantee.
And here we go to Passion of the Christ.
No, actually, we go to They / Them. Did I hear extremely loud gasp of air? Summoning desperation.
I'm trying to figure out which film that was. Go ahead.
It is the 2002, if I guess correctly, directly to streaming in Peacock, John Logan direction. John Logan being a dude who mostly has done script writing in Hollywood, and now making his directional debut. As a script writer, he has made some of some of the beloved classics like The Aviator for Scorsese, The Gladiator, Skyfall, and also some of the FlickLab favorite tier movies like Alien Covenant. And especially Spectre. So, Logan, bless his heart, is touching the difficult minefield of sexual orientation and identities. The LGBTQ plus field here.
I'm already on my defenses here, hearing all that prepping.
Yeah. And, well, goes as well as you can suspect from a guy who wrote Spectre. Holy shit. Like, oh my god. Like, it's a noble attempt. And to like, what? To give the dude some credit. It is his directional debut. It is his directional debut. These are thorny and complicated subject matters. And as a director, he makes some good calls. He actually, like, at least as far as I was able to track these actors, mostly all of them who are previously unknown to me, he takes actors who really are from the spectrum, which is great. So you have, like bi and trans and queer actors here playing bi, trans, and queer characters. And having those characters, that's great. And having those actors playing those characters, that's great. And nothing is as great as having Kevin Bacon in your film.
Mm.
Because Kevin Bacon is the man. He's so much man that his last name is like the best food ingredient in the world. So that's a great call. But the film just doesn't plain bloody work. It's a slasher film. It's one of those mysterious slasher films where you have like an isolated location, you have a group of people in the location and masked killer, and you know that one of them is the masked killer, and you most likely deduce like the killer like halfway through the film. If not, don't feel sorry about it, because it's at the end of the day, it's kind of a coin toss that you land in the right person. You see the red herring, and red herring is obvious red herring. And the story doesn't kind of go anywhere. It kind of just, there's the introduction to the situation, and they just kind of like stops. And they just like chuckles in that space until you get into the like final 15 minutes where mostly all of the murders happen. So it's really boring. And
are they splattering the victims all over the walls? Because sounds like this movie is also all over the walls.
Ooh, I wish there were. You have some good like corpse effects. But in fact, surprisingly little on-screen violence. Like, a lot of the murdering happens like just barely off the camera. You almost see the axe murder happen, but gosh darn, that door frame just happens to be there so that you quite miss it. Oh darn.
Damn door frame.
Yeah, so you don't even get like this super bloody violence there. The biggest thing that you get is Kevin Bacon, who is actually, if my notes are correct, he's actually one of the executive producers of the film. And, you know, kudos to the man. He does the heavy lifting here, not just being an executive producer or one of the producers, but also carrying the whole bloody thing on his shoulders. And oh boy, must the man have broad shoulders carrying this beast on them. Because Kevin Bacon is hands down the best thing in the film. And I would say, like, even though this has like that LGBTQ plus aspect to it, even with it, Kevin Bacon is the reason to check this film if you're gonna check it out. He gives his heart to save this turkey.
Nice, nice. Kevin Bacon is the man. Especially I can even envision, since Kevin Bacon and LGBTQ kind of could go well together, Kevin Bacon has been like a big horror phenomena, I guess, for LGBTQ and so forth audience ever since his, you know, I believe debut in Friday the 13th, part one, where he offered some of his bacon on screen.
Yeah. Kevin Bacon, curious, is one of those actors who never actually got into the same spotlight like something like Brad Pitt or you know, Johnny Depp, or, you know, other, like, he's a star, but he's not as bright a star as those guys, even though he had his chance, and he, by definition, he's giving his all, he's given his damnedest, but somehow, sometimes, Hollywood cars just don't line exactly fairly, and Kevin Bacon, unfortunately, kind of like Ethan Hawke, he's one of those unfortunate casualties of the Hollywood machine and who that machine lets to be the biggest stars of Hollywood. But yeah, Kevin Bacon is returning back to his horror roots, and, you know, God bless him for doing it. God bless him for, you know, practically saving as much as they shall ask them as possible.
All right.
But yeah, at the end of the day, can't recommend it.
Oh, well. Well, since we were talking about bacon here, would it be natural then to cross over to Dogs Don't Wear Pants, which you may have seen as well, Finnish film, which made some international waves.
Check it out once. Unfortunately, it did it in a festival screening being extremely tired, so I kind of was like, I remember that I liked it, but at the same time, I wasn't in the full mindset, which is a disservice to the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to put into words the film. You know, it's about this guy who has lost his wife in an accident, and then because he feels numb for this experience, he's trying to look for something to make him feel things again, and then this guy finds Mona, who is a dominatrix, and changes his life. And it turns into this kind of obsession towards the dominatrix, where Juha starts meeting with dominatrix. Also outside of work, is stalking the dominatrix. Ultimately, well, during the whole story, we get these little glimpses that there's something about dominatrix and Juha, that is, there's something going on between them. There is, at the very least, Mona's kind of acknowledgement and perhaps some kind of level of admiring towards Juha, how he is willing to go so far with something that he does as a professional service. So, going through all that pain, you know, it starts with something pretty not so sinister stuff like slapping on the ass, and then develops into perhaps something more violent by the end. Interesting exploration, kind of a story angle that you just really don't look into too often. Perhaps though, a little bit overlong, kind of overstated its welcome with the repeating scenes where they meet again and again, and where you kind of perhaps barely see anything, except maybe a little bit more by the end in terms of the violence. It's a moody, atmospheric, interestingly lit, defined colors and stuff. If you can find it, look it up. It was one of the, or I think it's fair to say it was the international export in terms of film from Finland in 2019. Didn't completely resonate with me either. I wasn't tired on my part when watching it. But great performance also from Krista Kosonen.
Okay, well, on my end, to continue with Kevin Bacon, I've been watching a lot of City on a Hill. It's a three-season kind of a crime series. Was cancelled after the third season, and I've heard that precisely cancelled, so perhaps were plans for, you know, season 4 and 5, we will never get them. I now been, I'm going into season two. I hope that season three manages to wrap up the whole story. And if I remember correctly, it's produced by Ben Affleck and Matt Damon. It takes place in 90s Boston. And it follows assisting district attorney played by Aldis Hodge, who makes a deal with a corrupt FBI agent, Jackie Rohr, played by Kevin Bacon. And especially in the first film, first season, they are tracking down this armored car robbery where three cars die in course of the robbery, and they try to follow, check out like where the guns came and who were the robbers, etc. And it's okay. It's pretty fine, but nothing like groundbreaking, nothing mind-blowing on its own right. I think that Aldis Hodge makes a pretty good performance as the district attorney, the Corsi Ward. The crime stories that or the case that each season revolves around of it's they are like okay, nothing groundbreaking. But I wanted to lead with They Slash Them and with a Kevin Bacon performance, because oh my god, this series has Kevin Bacon and the man is on fire here. He's even better than he was in They Slash Them. But not just, you know, carrying LGBTQ plus horror film. Kevin Bacon apparently carries three seasons of crime show also on his fucking shoulders. Because Kevin Bacon's performance as Jackie Rohr, if you're gonna check out City on a Hill, you're going to wanna check it out for Kevin Bacon. Absolutely, I think, one of my favorite corrupt cops / FBI agent performances I have seen for quite some time. Ooh. Kevin Bacon fucking nails it. The show itself is fine, but Kevin Bacon is the reason why I actually stick through the first season. In the end, continue to season two. And if Kevin Bacon stays as Kevin Bacon as he is here, I will check out the season three, because the dude just somehow manages to nail like absolute shitbag of a character, but captures it in a way that he brings in this energy which makes him, even though you absolutely loathe his character, Jackie Rohr, but you just wanna see him being an absolute shitbag. And Kevin Bacon nails that like 100% of the time. The dude manages to make, like, there's a scene where he just walks in a hallway and makes like hand gestures at empty the like office spaces, and he somehow, Kevin Bacon manages to make fucking walking down a hallway look cool. Christ, man, the man knows how to act. God damn it, where's the Oscar for Kevin Bacon? Seriously, like, I recommend City on a Hill, but only just so that you can see Kevin Bacon calling people fuckfaces and dickweeds and being an absolute asshole.
All right. Wow, that was a high recommendation sounding in terms of performance.
Yeah. Otherwise, like outside of performance, it's okay. It's okay, but Kevin Bacon truly is the one who carries the whole show.
Speaking of assholes, dickweeds, and the like, well, luckily they have nothing to do with the country, but Beyond Utopia, the last year's documentary, 2023 production, Beyond Utopia. Don't know if you have had the chance to hear about this. It's about a two-hour documentary, and well, I kind of wish we could have discussed this film on the podcast, but Henrik would probably boil me in oil if we would still watch yet another Korean-linked film here for the time being. To be absolutely honest, we haven't touched on anything Korea-related for quite some time, in my experience.
Mm-hmm. No, we have had quite a lengthy pause from Korea. Checking out a lot of Hollywood instead. Right.
But we have covered this topic before, in the last career-related anything, as far as I recall. Which is
now,
the...
what is this? This is army desertion gayness. Not.
Not quite there. It's escaping North Korea.
God damn it.
Yeah. The art of escaping North Korea. This film, I think it came under my radar when I was reading my email. Yeah, I guess those email notifications are sometimes handy. So there was this Liberty in North Korea. They sent me these news posts because I have donated money to them in the past. And actually, today I'm wearing my Liberty in North Korea t-shirt, which I also happened to buy a while ago. So a documentary film about kind of a comprehensive look and step-by-step look at how it is to escape from North Korea. Of course, if you have spent any time in the interwebs searching North Korea, the corners of the internet of North Korea, you would know how this is roughly going. How do you execute the escape from North Korea? You either cross the desert to Mongolia, once you get to China, of course. You do that on foot, you take the journey through the desert, or you choose the jungle. You go through the dangerous jungles and border crossings, finally ending up being most likely Thailand. So those are pretty much the sort of options, if you can call them such. So the material that you see in the documentary is nothing like revolutionary to people who have already tackled this topic, read about this topic, watched videos related to this topic. People walking in pitch black darkness in the jungle, and there's some grandma, of course, who injures her left ankle, or someone is on a kayak trying to make a border crossing or such, and somebody close to plunging into the water and taking all the other people with them because it's such a makeshift boat and so on. But yeah, it's absolutely dramatic to watch. It's horrifying. It's even really impressive. It's always impressive to watch this kind of material shot on kind of a handheld in the jungles and in the vans all around China, avoiding authorities. So it's a very well put together film. Absolutely. For the trained eye, when it comes to these topics, it's something that you have already seen. If you're a newcomer, however, to these topics, it's gonna make a pretty huge impact. And you're probably gonna give like rave reviews online for this, saying it's the best documentary of the year or the decade. It's a great watch. Maybe the interviews that are pasted in that are from some kind of, what was it, like CIA operatives and, you know, giving these very basic commentaries about, okay, you have Kim Jong-un and it's a very closed country and the economy is doing very bad compared to South Korea and there's this relationship with China and, you know, all the usual. But in terms of the subject matter, well put together, packaged, so definitely go watch it if you have the opportunity. It's doing the rounds in the festival still, but you should be able to watch it on the digital mediums because it just came out on the circulation online. So, yeah. But so I just wanted to ask Henrik, is this something that would appeal to you, or are you sick and tired of North Korea stories for now?
Well, not North Korean stories, not South Korean films, and not documentaries. Especially seeing how I visit Dog Point this year.
Nice.
To be the industry whore that I am.
Mm-hmm. Anything interesting there to whore about?
There were some... I must say that unfortunately, you know, work came up front and messed my screening schedule completely. So I didn't manage to check out as many films as I had planned. But from what I was able to see, yeah, there were some, like, not all of them, unfortunately, were as good as I had hoped. And unfortunately, my disappointments are landed in the films that I was perhaps the most interested about. I checked out Invoked, which is an archival footage-using movie documentary concerning about the Serbian civil war, which is a topic that we have visited twice already in the podcast. So, you know, the events are leading into the whole Pretty Village, Pretty Flame time period. Well, that one unfortunately kind of fell flat for me. The biggest problem was that it just didn't manage to find a narrative thread that I could follow. A large part of that, I believe, is the decision to use mostly archival footage. But it is also a storytelling problem of the movie. Like, the movie just... the director just can't find the thread so that someone who is not from the region or who is not intimately aware of the historical happenings and the timeline could actually follow it. Like, we researched the conflict and the events leading into it when we were doing Pretty Village, Pretty Flame, and that was a huge service now watching Invoked. And even with that background knowledge, it was really hard to actually follow what was happening and what people were referencing of and... It was just a mess at the end of the day. Granted, following from that mess, if the events are anyway as chaotic and kind of a crazy as the film makes out them being, you know, preceding the conflict, I can kind of... It's easy to see how something like Milosevic at the end of the day would be able to rise to power at the region.
Right.
Like, if the political system was in as shambles as Invoked presents that it was, preceding Milosevic, well, Milosevic kind of would have gotten, like, hand-down victory when he was aiming for the throne, simply by providing that, you know, he gets, you know, rid of all the political chaos and all the 15 million political parties that everybody was setting up.
Yeah, the law of war, whatever you want to call it, the special situations where also it raises concerns and questions, like in the situation of Ukraine and how much power the president, for example, at the present is wielding.
Yeah. And speaking of Ukraine, I also checked out Iron Butterflies, which is a Ukrainian document. It aims to showcase kind of the Russian provocation or Russian's mentality and its warlike nature, like, or to showcase the fact that Russia was actually actively planning the conflict before the current war or the current phase in the war started. Like, let's be clear, but the war has been going on ever since, you know, annexation of Crimea in 2014. It was just been kind of a frozen conflict up until, you know, 2 years ago when it finally turned extremely hot as Russian troops started to advance by en masse. But it's not like we kind of want to believe in the West that, oh, the war started 2 years ago. No, the war was going on.
Yep.
It was already going on. It was just in a frozen state. And this documentary is looking back at the frozen state, kind of with the idea, with the viewpoint that the West and Europe kind of really dropped the ball and we should have seen the warning signs in the air already. Mm-hmm. It mostly focuses on the Traveler airplane that Russian forces shut down.
Yep.
And especially the Russian media game surrounding the downing of the airplane. How first they took all the credit and were like, oh yeah, we you know, shut down a military airplane. And when it was proven that it was not a military airplane, then they were like, we don't know who shot it down. May have been us, may have been the Ukrainians. And then going full hard on the... it most definitely wasn't us. We are having our own inspections into the matter and they all prove that we are completely innocent here. This is just a blackmail campaign from NATO and EU. It tries to kind of show that the Russian media game surrounding the airplane, and it kind of manages to do that, but in large parts, unfortunately not. Just like Invoked, it very much just loses the narrative thread. And with that thread, it also kind of unfortunately can't make as strong argument than as it should be making, in my opinion. Because West and Europe, we all, Finland included, we have a lot of facing the mirror to do regarding how we actually reacted into firstly considering the invasion of Crimea and us, you know, just swallowing the whole "no, it's really an annexation" bullshit. And then our absolute like lack of balls when it came to dealing with Russia following that stunt, and our absolute like when now the war finally turned hot 2 years ago, the first months we were kind of like, oh, we don't know what's going on, and hiding our heads in the sand. There's a lot of shame that and guilt that we have to shoulder. So the film actually has a strong, could be aiming for a strong point, but it unfortunately, it loses the message when it loses a followable plot and followable story, which unfortunately happens. So that too kind of fell flat on its face, but kind of two highlights that I have from the festival would be Praying for Armageddon. Theater of Violence is about Hague human rights trial concerning one of the right-hand men of Joseph Kony. And really, it's a really interesting documentary about the different aspects that goes into a human rights trial in this type of a case, where there are different angles. There's a political angle, there's a historical angle, there's also the criminal law angle, and then there is also the personal angle of the accused. Like, what drove him to the actions in the first place. The Theater of Violence heavily focuses on the question of like the personal angle. Why did the right-hand man of Joseph Kony, why did he do all the atrocities and the crimes against humanity that he did, including war crime, including rape? Like, what was the motive behind him? And it paints really sympathetic picture of a man whose crimes are almost incomprehensible. And it manages to highlight very well the point that, you know, a kid who is abducted by Kony's army and brainwashed in the army pretty much likely turns into a pretty violent and horrible adult. Where the film kind of falters then is on the different aspects. It wants to point out that Hague as an entity is basically kind of a hand wash attempt from the West and Europe from all the days of colonialization. We are trying to kind of wash that our sordid history under the rug. So we have made Hague the big human rights tribunal in order to punish people and to show that we have somehow higher and mightier than we are, and to kind of help the world forget our past with colonialization. And that's a good point. The film kind of manages to land that. The film also kind of manages to land at the point that if we leave the sentencing of individuals like Kony's right-hand man to institutions like Hague, we are kind of also treading on the toes of the people who live on the area where these crimes happened and whose loved ones have been hurt by Kony and his cohorts. Like, if Hague passes the judgment and condemns the man, it means that the actual territory where the crimes were committed and the people living in that territory, they don't have actual say on how the man is being now punished, because Hague makes the moral judgment, the legal judgment on the matter. And that can actually harm the possibility of that region that has been harmed by Kony to actually get into a process of healing, because they are denied the right to actually inflict their own judgment on the people who are guilty. Where the film kind of falters more is in the aspect of studying the prosecution side. They are painted, the prosecution in this case is kind of painted by as the bad guys, but not really that strongly, which kudos to the film for not doing that. But unfortunately, alongside with not painting them as too much the bad guys, it also doesn't really look that deeply into their perspective. Because there is also a good questions with, you know, Joseph Kony's right-hand man's crimes, they are still crimes, they are still subjugated to the criminal law. If he's being brought in front of the Human Rights Tribunal in Hague, he's subjugated to the criminal laws of Hague. So how does exactly those laws face with the kind of a struggle with the fact that the defense is trying to paint the picture that the man should get a more lenient sentencing because he has been brainwashed by Kony as a child, so he's not fully, like, his guilt and his crimes are not fully of his. They are largely stemming from, you know, the treatment he received as a child in Kony's army. And that aspect is not actually, it's not really studied as deeply as I would have wanted to be studied. It also kind of does not that, it doesn't take a hard look into how this situation looks from Hague's perspective. Like all the political implications and ramifications that a case like this could have.
Mm.
And how Hague has to juggle as the quote-unquote neutral party in a conflict and in a question, in a criminal case question, that has two sides or in a region far removed from where Hague actually is. That's also it's a difficult political puzzle for Hague itself to actually solve. And that's one as angle and aspect that the film kind of just doesn't find a way to really inspect and study. So, not a complete hallmark victory, but still, I would say, pretty damn good documentary. And it's like, oh boy. Whoo, shit with this one. Oh, God.
Wow, well.
Yeah.